story of the spies. Today, we're looking at the conclusion of the spies and the choice of the people. Okay, we looked already in Numbers 13 at how there was a listing of the spies, and how if you compare Numbers 13 with Deuteronomy chapter 1, in one place it says God told Moses to do this. Another place, Moses says, you came to me and said this was a good idea. And it seems as though maybe the people came to Moses and said, hey, we want to do this. Moses went to the Lord. The Lord said, yeah, do it. I mean, that's the best way I can come up with to put the two together. But it seems as though, it seems. The Lord always has a purpose for those kinds of things, right? And God is allowing something that's been bubbling under the surface for a while to now come out. When we pick this story up here in Numbers 13 and 14, it's been 13, 14 months, something like that. Anywhere between 14 months and maybe as much as 2 years. Anywhere between a year and a half since they came out of Egypt. Okay, so just for easy, let's just say 15 months. Okay, 15 months ago, where were we as Maranatha Baptist Church? Okay, it was January. In December, we'd had the final service with Pastor Mike, Ms. Rach. Okay, it's January, so now we're looking at a different scenario. And you folks were patiently, but anxiously saying, hey, where are we? The pulpit committee process. You fast forward to March, we had just interviewed a man by the name of Davidson, right? And, things. But we can just, I just want you to think about in 15 months how much water's under the bridge, okay? From a transition to, okay, hey, we still don't know what's going to happen, to, okay, this looks like maybe where the Lord's leading us, and then on we go. All right, that's just been at 15 months. You can see in 15 months there's a lot of water under the bridge, okay? But they're only, 15 months, 18 months away from the 10 plagues, crossing the Red Sea, bitter water turned sweet, God giving them manna. More recently than that, they've seen God give them quails when they complained. Okay? The point is that it's not like it's been 40 years since they've seen God do something. Okay? God has been working in large and special ways. In that time, they met God at Mount Sinai. And they got the Ten Commandments. They got all the laws. They've gotten the instructions. And yet, through all of that, underneath the surface, there continues to bubble a discontent and an unbelief. Okay? So, the point that I'm driving at is this. It's not just dependent on what God does or what God shows us. At some point, we have to make a choice. Are we going to trust God and are we going to trust His Word? Or are we not? Okay? The conclusion of the spies is where we left off last time, the end of chapter 13. They talked about the giants and how fortified the cities were and all those kinds of things. So chapter 14, verse 1. All right, beginning here in chapter 14, verse 1, we're going to pick up today with the choice of the people. The choice of the people. On my outline, this is number 5 for the two chapters, but it's the first point we're going to look at today. The choice of the people, verse 1. All the congregation lifted up their voice and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron. The whole congregation said unto them, would God that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would God we had died in the wilderness. You think they really meant that? All right, stop and think about what they're really saying. Man, I wish we'd died in Egypt. I wish I'd never seen God send the plagues on Egypt and bring us out. I wish I'd never seen God part the Red Sea. But you know, when you get focused on self, you get focused on problems, you get discouraged, you allow fear instead of faith to dominate your thinking, you can make some pretty dumb statements, right? And that's what they're doing here. Would God we died in the land of Egypt. Would God we died in the wilderness. Wherefore hath the Lord brought us unto this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and our children should be a prey. Were it not better for us to return into Egypt? Well, is it? No. And they said one to another, let us make a captain and let us return into Egypt. Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation of the children of Israel. And Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, which were of them that searched the land, rent their clothes. And they spake unto all the company of the children of Israel, saying, the land which we passed through to search it is an exceeding good land. If the Lord delight in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it us, a land which floweth with milk and honey. Only rebel not ye against the Lord, neither fear ye the people of the land, for they are bread for us. Their defense is departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Fear them not. But all the congregation bade stone them with stones. All right, we'll stop there for now. Okay? The choice of the people, they have seen God do things that were significant, things that were monumental, things that we've never seen in a physical sense. And yet, the people collectively, there are individuals who have come to this conclusion on their own, but the people collectively have not yet come to that point where they said, if God can do this, God can take care of whatever else I'm going to face, whatever else we're going to face. You see, God doesn't give us unrealistic expectations. God has showed them. I mean, the first thing he did was he gave Moses signs, right? Remember, God appeared to Moses, the burning bush, and then he said, all right, when you get there, I want you to take your stick and throw it on the ground. I want you to take your hand and stick it in your coat and pull it out, and it's going to turn leprous. God had given them indications to say, hey, look, here's the power of God working. And then it got bigger with the plagues. And then it got bigger with the Red Sea. God gives us those things to strengthen our faith. But the point of those things is to strengthen our faith. Okay? There comes a point when we're not just making deposits, if you will, in the memory bank or in the faith bank, if you want to say it that way. There comes a time when you got to make a withdrawal, or you got to draw on what's been banked up to this point. Okay? God has worked on their behalf and showed them, and he's promised them and all of these things, but now the people's responsibility is to make a choice. Are we going to look at the problem, or are we going to look at the promise of God and say, all right, here's what God's promised, and look at what all God has done up until this point. God can certainly take care of this too. Okay? That's while we're not looking at conquering Hebron or the land of Israel, there's certainly application for us. Okay? In whatever circumstances we have faced or currently face or will face, God expects us to look at His pattern of faithfulness, look at His works up until this point, and draw the conclusion, if God could take care of this, then God can take care of what I'm facing now. Okay? That's always the case. Now, as we grow in our walk with the Lord, and as we grow in our responsibilities in life, those things that we're facing get bigger. Okay? I mean, there was a time when I wondered, how I was going to come up with, $800 so I could pay my school bill and take my final exams. Okay? And if that were the biggest problem I ever had to deal with, boy, wouldn't that be great? I mean, at the time, it may as well have been Goliath, right? It was big to me. And yet, through that, then the Lord says, okay, if I can take care of this, then I can take care of this, then I can take care of this. Joshua and Caleb, in their exhortation to the people here, basically said, God can give it to us. God has promised it to us, and God is with us. All right? They had it figured out. But the people were continuing to walk by sight, to walk by fear, to walk with a carnal mindset. So the choice that they made was, well, two things here. They made a decision, first of all, not to trust God. Okay? Sometimes we would say, hey, you need to make a choice to trust God. But there is no middle ground. There's not A, B, and C. Trust God, don't trust God, neutral. Okay? There is no neutral. Okay? If you do not choose to trust God in your situation, then you are making a choice not to trust God. Okay? Now, that's uncomfortable, because I would prefer to, at times, sit back and just kind of, wait and see, or, we're human, okay? Just because we know what we should do doesn't mean we always do it, right, or do it the first time. But the reality is, there is no middle ground. If you do not choose to trust God, you are choosing not to trust God in whatever the situation is. Okay? If you refuse to step forward and trust God by faith in whatever that circumstance is, you are, whether you consciously process that or not, you are choosing not to trust God. And that's what the people of Israel did here. They chose not to trust God. Caleb and Joshua stood up and said, look, God can give it to us. God is with us. And you notice their response, verse 10, all the congregation bade stone them with stones. If there was any question mark about what their choice was, it's clear right here. Stone them! We don't want to hear any more about this God can do it stuff. God brought us out here to die. Okay? They made their choice not to trust God. And then they made a decision to return to Egypt. Now, it was kind of short-lived. But verse 4, they said, let us make a captain and return to Egypt. Okay? They have rebelled against Moses up to this point. Aaron and Miriam even spoke against Moses. But something this severe has not been outwardly voiced up till this point. Nobody has said, hey, let's make a new captain and let's go back to Egypt. That hasn't been publicly voiced until now. They said, hey, let's make a captain and go back to Egypt. Okay? Why? What is in Egypt for them? Slavery? Servitude? Hard labor? Whatever privileges they had built up, you know, whatever good things they thought they had, do you think if they go back to Egypt now, they're getting those back? I mean, right now, Israel is to Egypt the height of their humiliation. I mean, God has humiliated the power of Egypt in how He brought them out and how He eventually drowned the Egyptian army in the Red Sea. If they were to go back to Egypt, Egypt would make it a point to humiliate them and to show that their God was again superior to the God of Israel and all of those things. They're not getting any good thing if they went back to Egypt. I mean, just think about, you know, 1776, you have Declaration of Independence, you have the War for Independence and all those things. Along about 1780, 1781, what if some of them said, you know what, this is crazy, let's move back to England. How do you think that's going to go? You're going to be executed for treason. Okay? Nothing's going to be good. But when you leave the ground of faith, all that's left to use fleshly reasoning, and you can say some really crazy things. Hey, let's go back to Egypt. Hey, you know, would God we died in the wilderness. Hey, would God that we died in Egypt and never came out to start with. God brought us out here to kill our children. And when you move from faith to fleshly reasoning, you come up with some really crazy stuff. They made a decision not to trust God. They made a decision, hey, let's return to Egypt. Thankfully, they stayed out of that. But I want you to notice here in the first four verses of Numbers 14, I want you to see here with me three stages of disobedience. You see here mourning or sorrow in verse 1. All the congregation lifted up their voice and cried, and the people wept that night. That must have been quite the scene, don't you think? A couple million people. And, you know, they were not like us. I mean, they were prone to more public displays. You know, so they're wailing and weeping and all this kind of... I mean, you get that many people and everybody's, you know, pitching a fit. That could have been a real unpleasant scene, right? But there's mourning, there's sadness, okay? But this was unhappiness brought about by their own sin. Their sin of unbelief. Okay? So you have mourning, and then you have murmuring. Verse 2, all the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against the congregation. And we drop down to the end of the chapter. We see several references again to their murmuring. Verse 27, I've heard the murmurings of the children of Israel, which they murmur against me. And that's several places in this chapter. Okay? So you have mourning, then you have murmuring. If I'm going to apply it to us, that would be lashing out, taking it out on other people, when the reality is it's conviction in my own heart for my own disobedience. Conviction in your heart. You know, if you're not right with God and you know it, you're a miserable person to be around. So am I. Okay? But here, they refuse to obey God. The unhappiness is brought about by their own sinful choice. Now there's murmuring, there's lashing out, there's complaining, there's blaming others. Moses, it's your fault. God, it's your fault for bringing us out to start with. And then you end up with mutiny. Mourning, murmuring, and then mutiny. Let's make a captain and return to Egypt. Okay? Basically what they're saying was it would have been better for us in Egypt. by application, you know, sometimes Christians might say, hey, my life was better, my life was easier, my life was more enjoyable before I got saved and started trying to live for God. You can never go back. You can never go back to that. Even if you do try to go back to a sinful life, there's not going to be the enjoyment there that there was as an unbeliever. There is a pleasure in sin for a season, but the child of God can never go back and enjoy that kind of stuff. Okay? But here, you know, that's the stages that they followed. Hey, first there's unhappiness, and then there's lashing out, and now we're going to try to do a 180 and go back. The choice of the people, they made a decision not to trust God. I want you to notice with me now, in verse number 10, and following the concern of Moses, all the congregation bade stone them with stones, and the glory of the Lord appeared in the tabernacle of the congregation before all the children of Israel. The Lord said unto Moses, how long will this people provoke me? And how long will it be ere they believe me for all the signs which I've showed among them? That's exactly what I started with this morning. God showed them all of these things, and God said, what's it going to take for them to believe me? I will smite them with the pestilence and disinherit them, and will make of thee a greater nation and mightier than they. And Moses said unto the Lord, sounds good, let's do it. Is that what your text says? I hope not. Then the Egyptian, Moses unto the Lord, the Egyptians shall hear it, for thou broughtest this people in thy might from among them, and they will tell it to the inhabitants of this land, for they have heard that thou, the Lord, art among this people, and that thou, Lord, art seen face to face, and thy cloud standeth over them, and that thou goest before them by daytime in a pillar of cloud, and a pillar of fire by night. Now if thou shalt kill all this people as one man, then the nations which have heard the fame of thee will speak, saying, because the Lord was not able to bring this people into the land which he sware unto them, therefore hath he slain them in the wilderness. And now I beseech thee, let the power of my Lord be great, according as thou hast spoken, saying, the Lord is long-suffering and of great mercy, forgiving iniquity and transgression, by no means clearing the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation. Pardon, I beseech thee, the iniquity of this people, according unto the greatness of thy mercy, as thou hast forgiven this people from Egypt, even until now. Who are the people complaining against? God and Moses. Okay? When they said, let us make a captain, who are they specifically trying to replace? Moses. And yet, Moses' concern was not for himself. You see here in verse 10, we see the appearance of God. The glory of the Lord appeared in the tabernacle. And then we see the intercession of Moses. When God said, Moses, let me get rid of them and start over with you, Moses never even acknowledged it. And Moses just ignored that. He brushed it to the side and he just began to give his prayer to God. See, this is a case of where God made an offer knowing what the result would be. Okay? And he did it for our benefit. Moses here was completely unselfish. His concern was for the glory of God, the testimony to the world. He said, God, if you do this, the Egyptians and the people of this land are going to have a lower view of you because of it. That was his concern. His concern was not for himself, that he had been insulted. His concern was not for his prominence. Hey, yeah, it can be all my family, this new nation. He said, God, your name is going to be run in the mud by all these other nations. All right. That's a very convicting question if we stop and think about it. What's more important to me? My name, my reputation, my testimony, what people think of me, or what people think of my God? What's more important to you, what people think of you, or what they think of your God? You know, that's a very searching question. That is our motive. That's one of the reasons God trusted Moses with what he did, because he knew that Moses' concern at this point was going to be for the glory of God and the good of the people, not for himself. He said, Lord, your name. And then he said, Lord, your testimony. They're going to say, well, God couldn't bring these people in, so he just killed them in the wilderness. Moses interceded. Moses demonstrated unselfishness, meekness, godliness. All of these things are demonstrated right here in Moses' simple prayer. Lord, if you do that, your name's going to be run in the mud. Now he said, I beseech thee. And then verse 19, pardon, I beseech thee, the iniquity. This is interesting to me. Just a little side note here. Look at verse 17. And now I beseech thee, let the power of my Lord be great. When you think about praying for the power of God or even describing the power of God, what do you think about? Maybe folks getting saved? That's a demonstration of the power of God, right? We think about, in this context, we think about, boy, parting the Red Sea or providing manna in the wilderness or bringing the plagues. Let the power of God be great. Do you notice? He said, let the power of God be great. Let the power of God be demonstrated. And then what was he asking for? Let the power of my Lord be great, according as thou hast spoken, saying, the Lord is long-suffering and of great mercy, forgiving iniquity of transgression. You realize that it's a demonstration, the power of God, when he forgives you and he forgives me. I mean, that's just as much a demonstration of the power of God as if we see an earthquake or a hurricane or Mount Sinai on fire. Here he said, Lord, demonstrate your great power in forgiving this people. Moses has done this before. Can you think of another incident Moses has prayed something similar? Exodus 32, what's that story? Golden calf. Moses went to God and said, God, would you forgive these people? And that's the same context in which God showed his glory to Moses in Exodus 33, and he when the glory of God passed by, Moses said, the Lord God, merciful and gracious and forgiving iniquity. This is wrapped up in what God's somewhat recently showed Moses, okay? But he said, Lord, let your power be great in forgiving. Verse 19, pardon the iniquity of his people. Verse 20, the Lord said, I have pardoned according to thy word. All right? So we see here the concern of Moses. And then number three, we see the condemnation of the spies and the people. Verse 20, the Lord said, I have pardoned according to thy word, but as truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord. Moses, the earth will be filled with my glory. Now, in one sense, does it matter a lick what the Egyptians think of God? Does that diminish who God is? Okay? Does that take anything away from God's power or God's person? No. Okay? But in another sense, it does matter in that we want the God to be seen for who he is. Right? Okay? And that's the context. But here, God said, the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. But then, notice, because all those men which have seen my glory and my miracles, which I did in Egypt, in the wilderness, and have tempted me now these 10 times, and have not hearkened to my voice, surely they shall not see the land which I swear unto their fathers, neither shall any of them that provoke me see it. But my servant Caleb, because he had another spirit with him and had followed me fully, him will I bring into the land whereinto he went, and his seed shall possess it. Now the Amalekites and Canaanites dwell in the valley. Tomorrow turn you, get you into the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea. The Lord spake unto Moses and Aaron, saying, how long shall I bear with this evil congregation which murmur against me? I have heard the murmurings of the children of Israel which they murmur against me, saying to them, as truly as I live, saith the Lord, as ye have spoken in my ears, so will I do to you. It's almost, did your mom or dad ever say, all right, you get to choose your punishment? Well, that didn't happen very often, but that's never really a fun choice. But they chose their punishment here. Verse 29, your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness, and all that were numbered of you according to your whole number from 20 years old and upward, which have murmured against me, doubtless ye shall not come into the land concerning which I swear to make you dwell therein, save Caleb the son of Jephunneh and Joshua the son of Nun. But your little ones, which ye said should be a prey, them will I bring in, and they shall know the land which ye have despised. But as for you, your carcasses shall fall in the wilderness. Your children shall wander in the wilderness 40 years and bear your whoredoms until your carcasses be wasted in the wilderness. All right, look back at verse 18. The Lord is long-suffering and of great mercy, forgiving iniquity and transgression, and by no means clearing the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children. Everything in that statement is fulfilled in God's pronouncement. Okay? God was merciful. He didn't wipe them all out on the spot. God was merciful in that he spaced it out and allowed them to die over a period of time, allowed the new generation to come up and to be prepared and all of those things. And yet, those that refused to trust God, that sinned by unbelief, they died. And notice, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children under the third and fourth generation. All right, let's just say that you're 18. That young man that's 17, 18 years old, okay? So you're under that cutoff. You're not going to die because you're in the number that's 20 or up. But you're 18 years old. How old are you going to be before you ever get a chance to go into the promised land? 58, if you can do math, right? And if we say, all right, it's been a year or two, So, all right, maybe 56. You get the point. The point is that the children reaped the consequences of decisions the parents had made. That's the idea of visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children. Not that, okay, if my parents sinned or my parents were alcoholics or drug addicts or whatever you want to say, then you know I'm automatically doomed. But parents, there are consequences to our decisions. And the choices that we make affect our children, and in some cases, grandchildren. Okay? The children and grandchildren had to wander in the wilderness for 38, 39 years before they had an opportunity to go into the promised land. They were, in fact, reaping the consequences of the choices that the parents had made. So you have here God's judgment. Okay? He said here, exactly what you said is going to happen. Your carcasses are going to fall in the wilderness. Now, the opposite of what something else you said is going to happen, your children that you said were going to get eaten up, they're going to be the ones that are going to go in and see my power and see my victory. Okay? Drop down to verse 35. I, the Lord, have said, I will surely do it unto this evil congregation all that are gathered together against me in this wilderness. They shall be consumed, and there they shall die. And the men, verse 36, which Moses sent to search the land, who returned and made all the congregation to murmur against him by bringing up a slander upon the land, even those men that did bring up the evil report upon the land died by the plague before the Lord. They didn't die over a period of time. They died immediately. Okay? The verse that's ringing out in my mind as I read this is James chapter 3, verse 1. My brethren, be not many masters, knowing that we shall receive the greater condemnation. For many things we offend all. And that chapter goes on to talk about the tongue. But the principle there is that the teacher or the leader, the master, has a greater responsibility. So these men who had been tasked with the responsibility of viewing the land and in essence being God's leaders or God's voice, hey, here's the situation. And they should have pointed the people back to a trust in God like Joshua and Caleb tried to do. When they instead fueled the fires of unbelief that were burning in the hearts of the people, God held them to a higher standard of accountability. It's a scary thing. You say, well, that's good for me because I'm not a Sunday school teacher. You have children, you're a teacher. You have grandchildren, you're a teacher. And if you have any position of leadership, teaching, or those types of responsibility, that is a biblical truth. There is a greater responsibility there. And when those men sinned against God in unbelief, God judged them there publicly. God made a distinction. Joshua and Caleb, they followed me. They're going to see the land. You ten are dead. Okay? God is long-suffering. But by this point, God had allowed to be publicly demonstrated what He already knew. Did God know the heart of the people was going to be unbelieving? Yeah. But He just allowed this scenario to play out where it became obvious to everybody else. Okay, but by this point, no further amount of time, no further miracles were going to change the scenario. Either they're going to believe God or they aren't. So, God judged them. God judged the people. Disobedient servants and rebellious soldiers will be punished. Are we the servants of the Lord? Yes, we should be. That word servants used over and over and over again in the New Testament. All right, in 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus, Paul exhorts the young men to fight as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. So we could say both servant and soldier is applicable to us. Disobedient servants and rebellious soldiers will be punished. Both of those things were true here. As spies, they were the servants of the Lord. As Israel, they were in the army of the Lord. They were disobedient. They were rebellious. They were guilty of dereliction of duty, and God judged them. You know, I may have mentioned this last week. I don't exactly remember. But this just flies in the face of the prosperity gospel. Okay, or the thinking. Now, the prosperity gospel, we all agree we're against. But let me just bring it a little closer to home. Sometimes we think that if it's the will of God, then it will be easy. Okay, Just because it's the will of God does not automatically mean that it will be easy. I'll read you a couple of verses. Romans chapter 8, verse 37. Nay, in all these things we are more than conquerors through Him that loved us. But the verses prior to that, he talks about all kinds of opposition and difficulty. Okay? And if we go through the New Testament, we could see instance after instance where God says, you're going to have to fight. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, Paul describes the Christian walk as the word is from the word where we get agony or to agonize. It is a struggle. It is a fight. And that concept is throughout the New Testament. Just because it's the will of God doesn't mean there won't be difficulty. Doesn't mean it won't require effort. Doesn't mean that we won't have to work. Doesn't mean we won't have to sweat or maybe even have a little pain in the process. The will of God is good, but it's not automatically easy. And Israel somehow thought that, okay, if there's opposition and there's difficulty and there's problems, then, okay, God must not be with us. No, just because there's difficulty does not mean that they're out of the will of God. God uses those things to strengthen us. What is God's evaluation of this entire situation? It's interesting, in the end of Numbers chapter 14, the people said, hey, verse 40, we've sinned. Verse 39, Moses told these things. Verse 40, we've sinned. But the people decided they were going to get up their own army and go up and conquer the land anyway. Oh, okay, God really did mean it. We're going to go conquer the land, and they lost. Okay? That is the height of presumption. Okay? They presumed that they could go without the power of God, without the presence of God, and go accomplish something. They presumed that now on their own, they could accomplish what they were fearful the day before to accomplish with the help of God. This doesn't make any sense. What's God's estimation of this whole thing? Let's turn to Hebrews chapter 3, and that's where we'll close today. Hebrews chapter 3. You want an interesting study? Look up the term day of provocation. All right, Hebrews chapter 3, verse 6. That's not what I'm looking for, verse 8. We'll start in verse 7 for context. Wherefore, as the Holy Ghost saith, today if you will hear His voice, harden not your hearts as in the provocation in the day of temptation in the wilderness. If we go back to Psalm 95, Psalm 106, this is almost an exact quote from Psalm 95 and Psalm, I believe it's 63. But the term there is used, the day of provocation. Harden not your hearts as in the provocation, the day of temptation in the wilderness, when your fathers tempted me, proved me, and saw my works 40 years. Wherefore I was grieved with that generation, and said they do always err in their heart. Okay, verse 12, take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. That word evil is the word paneros. It's the same word that we get our word, that's the word evil, right? The word unbelief just simply means that, no faith, not believing. Do you know how God described that? I mean, this same word paneros or evil is used to describe murder or adultery, and yet God describes unbelief in the same way. Okay? God calls unbelief wickedness or evil. If we were to list sins and how we categorize them, we would not put unbelief on the same side of the ledger as murder, adultery, fornication, larceny, armed robbery. And yet God does. An evil heart of unbelief is what He calls it. Okay, verse 16, for some when they had heard did provoke, howbeit not all they that came out of Egypt by Moses, but with whom was he grieved 40 years? Was it not with them that had sinned, whose carcasses fell in the wilderness? To whom swear he that they should not enter into his rest? All right, so we're clearly talking about this story in Numbers. God said, all right, fine, you're not going to enter into my rest. You're not going to enter into my promised land. So this incident of an evil heart of unbelief and of provocation in Hebrews 3 is clearly talking about this story that we've been looking at in Numbers 13 and 14. All right, Hebrews 4, drop down to verse number 11. Let us labor, therefore, to enter into that rest, lest any man fall after the same example of unbelief. That word example means a pattern to be copied. So you know what? the exhortation to the Hebrew Christians was that they would not do the same thing that their Hebrew brethren had done centuries before. But the clear teaching of Scripture here is that it is possible. It was possible for them to have the same type of heart of unbelief in New Testament times as Israel did in the wilderness, which means it's possible for us, right? The Scripture said that these things were given for our admonition. But the pleading by the writer of Hebrews, who I think is the Apostle Paul, but nonetheless, the pleading here is that they would not provoke the Lord with unbelief. I greatly agreed with what Pastor Chris Edwards, he preached Friday morning at the Bible conference over at Ambassador. And there's he touched on this. There's a mindset that, boy, it's never been any as wicked as it is today, and it's never been as difficult, and boy, things are just different, and we should just hope we can hold on till Jesus comes. That's focusing on our problems instead of focusing on the power of God. Sin is sin. Wickedness has always been wicked. And if you want to know, has it ever been this bad? Go look at Sodom. Go look at Ephesus. Go look at Rome. Go look at, you know, cities throughout history if you really learn what's going on. Has it been this bad in America before? Not likely. I mean, there was some of this going on, and then God allowed the Great Awakenings. Has it been this bad in this way in America? No. But has it ever been this bad before in history? Yeah. And it's the same God. But see, if we're not careful, we can fall into that, I don't know how things are going to go, and the end result of that is an evil heart of unbelief. Okay? I can be guilty of this. You can be guilty of this. We as a church can be guilty of this if we refuse to take the promises of God at face value and to go forward in faith. If we look at our problems, we look at our circumstances, or we look at the difficulties, instead of looking at the power of God and the promises of God, we can be just as guilty of an evil heart of unbelief as Israel was. Sometimes we think, well, you know, we didn't refuse to go into the promised land. But you know, if we don't take the promises of God and go forward confidently on those promises, as we started out this morning, if we don't come to the point individually where we make a choice, God, to say, all right, God will keep His word. I'm going to choose to take God at His word. Okay? If we don't come to that point, then we can eventually slide back to the position here where we end up with an evil heart of unbelief. I don't want that to be said of me. But I don't want it to be said of Maranatha Baptist Church. I don't want that to be said of any of us. But if we would avoid that pitfall, there must be a constant choice, a conscious choice and a constant choice on our part to say, all right, I'm going to take the promises of God at face value and I'm going to go forward. I'm going to pray, I'm going to seek God's face, I'm going to claim the promises of God, but then we're going to move forward and expect to see it happen instead of just kind of shrivel and hover in the corner in fear. You take that and you think about that. Ask the Lord to show us what promises we need to claim and go forward. I would try to make more application, but I'm out of time. But the choice of Israel, the concern of Moses, the condemnation of the people and the spies. If we don't want to fall into condemnation, we must make the choice that Joshua and Caleb did. If the Lord's with us, we can do this.